Fine. This origin's silver is concentrated into a relative few bright lines that all align in similar directions. They don't flicker, and neither does his torus. He, you guessed that, but it feels right, is listening. Yika, another outline of precise concentrated silver, nods in satisfaction. She climbs up on top of some of the wagon cargo, so her voice will carry better. I'm Yika Roga Kastrima, she calls. You guess that she points at you. She's a Roga too. So is he. Tamil. So are those kids over there. We don't kill Rogas here. She pauses. You hungry? We've got a little to spare. You don't need to try to take it. That fulcrum doesn't budge. Something else does, though. From the other side of the stone forest, as thin, attenuated agglomerations of silver suddenly blur into chaotic movement and come charging toward you. Other raiders. Evil Earth! You were all so focused on the Raga that you didn't even notice the ones behind you. You hear them now, though. Voices rising, cursing, feet pounding on ashy sand. The strongbacks near the barrier of stakes on that side cry warning. They're attacking, you call. No shit, Ika snaps, drawing a glass knife. You retreat to within the tent circle, acutely aware of your vulnerability, in a way that's strange and deeply unpleasant. It's worse because you can still sess, and because your instincts prompt you to respond when you see where you could help. A cluster of attackers comes at a part of the perimeter that's light on stakes and defenders, and you open your eyes so you can actually see them trying to fight their way in. They're typical, calmless raiders, filthy, emaciated, dressed in an ash-faded combination of rags and newer pilfered clothing. You could take out all six in half a breath with a single precision torus. But you can also feel how... What? How aligned you are? Yika's silver is concentrated, like that of the other Ragas you've observed, but hers is still layered, jagged, a little jittery. It flows every which way within her as she jumps down from the cargo wagon and shouts for people to help the sparse strongbacks near that cluster of raiders running to help herself. Your magic flows with smooth clarity. Every line matching perfectly in direction and flow to every other line. You don't know how to change it back to the way it was, if that's even possible. And you know instinctively that using the silver when you're like this will pack every particle of your body together as neatly as a mason lays a wall of bricks. You'll be stone the same way. So you fight your instincts and hide. Much as that rankles. There are others here, crouching amid the central circle of tents, the calm, smaller children, its bare handful of elders, one woman so pregnant that she can't move with any real flexibility, even though she's got a loaded crossbow in her hands, two knife-wielding breeders who've obviously been charged with defending her and the children. When you poke your head up to observe the fighting, you catch a glimpse of something stunning. Danil, having appropriated one of the spear-whittled sticks that form the fence, is using it to carve a bloody swath through the raiders. She's phenomenal, spinning and stabbing and blocking and stabbing again, twirling the stick in between attacks as if she's fought calmless a million times. That's not just being an experienced strongback, that's something else. She's just too good. But it follows, doesn't it? Not like Renanus made her the general of their army for her charm. It isn't much of a fight in the end. 20 or 30 scrawny calmless against trained, fed, prepared calm members. This is why calms survive seasons, and why long-term calmlessness is a death sentence. This lot was probably desperate. There can't have been much traffic along the road in the past few months. What were they thinking? Their origin, you realize? That's who they expected to win this fight for them. But he's still not moving, orogenically or physically. You get up, walking past the lingering knots of fighting. Self-consciously adjusting your mask, you step off the road and slip through the perimeter stakes, moving into the deep darkness of the stone forest. The firelight of the camp leaves you nightblind, so you stop a moment to allow your eyes to adjust. No telling what kinds of traps the calmless have left here. You shouldn't be doing this alone. Again you're surprised, though, because between one blink and the next, you suddenly begin to see, in silver, insects, leaf litter, a spider web, even the rocks. All of it now flickers in wild veined patterns, their cells and particulates etched out by the lattice that connects them. And people. You stop as you make them out, well camouflaged against the silver bloom of the forest. The Raga is still where he's been, a brighter etching against more delicate lines. But there are also two small shapes crouched in a cavelet about 20 feet further into the forest. Two other bodies, somehow high overhead atop the jagged, curving rocks of the forest. Lookouts, maybe. None of them move much. Can't tell if they've seen you, or if they're watching the battle somehow. You're frozen, startled by this sudden shift in your perception. Is this some byproduct of learning, to see silver in yourself and the obelisks? Maybe once you can do that, you see it everywhere. Or maybe you're hallucinating all of it now, like an afterimage against your eyelids. After all, Alabaster never mentioned being able to see like this. But then, when did Alabaster ever try to be a good teacher? You grope forward for a bit, hand out in front of you in case it is some kind of illusion. But if so, it's at least an accurate one. While it's strange to put your foot down on a lattice of silver, after a while, you get used to it. The origin's distinctive lattice and that still-held torus aren't far, but he's somewhere higher up than the ground. Maybe 10 feet above where you stand. This is explained somewhat when the ground abruptly slopes upward and your hand touches stone. Your regular vision has adapted enough that you can see there's a pillar here, crooked and probably climbable, at least by someone who's got more than one arm. So you stop at the foot of it and say, "Hey!" No response. You become aware of breathing, quick, shallow, pent, like someone who's trying not to be heard breathing. "Hey!" Squinting in the dark, you finally make out some kind of structure of stacked branches and old boards and debris. A blind, maybe. From up there in the blind, it must be possible to see the road. Sight doesn't matter for the average origin. Untrained ones can't direct their power at all. A fulcrum-trained origin, though, needs line of sight to be able to distinguish between freezing useful supplies or just freezing the people defending same. Something shifts in the blind above you. Has there been a catch in the breathing? You try to think of something to say, but all that's in your head is a question. What's a fulcrum-trained origin doing among the calmless? Must have been out on an assignment when the rifting occurred, without a guardian, or he'd be dead. So that means he's 5th ring or higher, or maybe a 3 or 4 ringer who's lost their higher-ranked partner. You envision yourself, if you'd been on the road to Alia when the rifting struck, knowing your guardian might come for you, but gambling that he might instead write you off for dead. No, that ends the imagining right there. Shafa would have come for you. Shafa did come for you. But that was between seasons. Guardians supposedly do not join calms when seasons come, which means they die, and, in fact, the only guardian you've seen since the rifting was that one with Danil in the Renanis army. She died in the boilbug storm that you invoked, and you're glad of it, since she was one of the bear skin killers, and there's more than the usual wrong with that kind. Either way, here's another ex-black jacket out here alone, and maybe afraid, and maybe hair-triggered to kill. You know what that's like, don't you? But this one hasn't attacked yet. You have to find some way to make a connection. I remember, you say. It's soft, a murmur, like you don't want to hear even yourself. I remember the crucibles, the instructors, killing us to save us. Did they make you have children too? Corundum, your thoughts jerk away from memories. Did they? Shit. The hand that Shafa once broke, your right hand, is somewhere in whatever passes for Hoa's belly. You still feel it, though. Phantom ache across phantom bones. I know they broke you. Your hand. All of us. They broke us so they could... You hear very clearly a soft, horrified inhalation from within the blind. The torus whips into a blurring, blistering spin and explodes outward. You're so close that it almost catches you. That gasp was enough warning, though, and so you've braced yourself orogenically, even if you couldn't do so physically. Physically, you flinch, and it's too much for your precarious one-armed balance. You fall backward, landing hard on your ass. But you've been drilled since childhood in how to retain control on one level, even as you lose it in another. So in the same instant, you flex your sesapine and simply slap his fulcrum out of the earth, inverting it. You're much stronger. It's easy. You react magically, too, grabbing those whipping tendrils of silver that the torus has stirred, and belatedly you realize orogeny affects magic, but isn't magic itself. In fact, the magic flinches away from it. That's why you can't work high-level orogeny without negatively impacting your ability to deploy magic. How nice to finally understand. Regardless, you tamp the wild threads of magic back down and quell everything at once so that nothing worse than a rime of frost dusts your body. It's cold, but only on your skin. You'll live. Then you let go. And all the orogeny and magic snaps away from you like stretched rubber. Everything in you seems to twang in response, in resonance, and... Oh. Oh, no. You feel the amplitude of the resonance rise as your cells begin to align and compress into stone. You can't stop it. You can, however, direct it. In the instant that you have... You decide which body part you can afford to lose. Hair. No, too many strands. Too much of it distant from the live follicles. You can do it, but it'll take too long and half your scalp will be stone by the time you're done. Toes. You need to be able to walk. Fingers. You've only got one hand. Need to keep it intact as long as you can. Breasts. Well, you're not planning on having more children anyway. It's enough to channel the resonance, the stoning, into just... One. Have to take it through the glands under the armpit, but you manage to keep it above the muscle layer. That might keep the damage from impairing your movement and breathing. You pick the left breast to offset your missing right arm. The right breast is the one you always liked better anyway. Prettier. And then you lie there when it's done, still alive, hyper-aware of the extra weight on your chest, too shocked to mourn. Yet. Then you're pushing yourself up, awkwardly grimacing, as the person in the blind utters a nervous little chuckle and says, Oh, Rust! Oh, Earth! Tamiya? It really is you! Sorry about the Taurus, I was just... You don't know what it's been like. I can't believe it. Do you know what they did to Crack? Akete, says your memory. Mashish, says your mouth. It's Mashish. Mashish is half the man he used to be. Physically, anyway. He's got no legs below the thighs, One eye, or rather only one that works. The left one is clouded with damage, and it doesn't track quite with the other. The left side of his head, he's got almost nothing left of that lovely blonde ash blow that you remember, just a knife-hacked bottle brush, is a mess of pinkish scars amid which you think the ears healed shut. The scars have seamed his forehead and cheek, and pull his mouth a little out of true on that side. Yet he wriggles down from the blind nimbly, walking on his hands and lifting his torso and stumpy legs with sheer muscle as he does so. He's too good at getting around without legs. Must have been doing it for a while now. He makes it over to you before you're able to climb to your feet. It really is you. I thought, I heard you were only fourth ring. Did you really punch through my Taurus? I'm a sixer. Six! But that's how I knew, see. You still cess the same. Still quiet on the outside, and rusting furious on the inside. It really is you. The other calmless are starting to creep down from their spires and such. You tense as they appear, scarecrow figures thin and ragged and stinking, watching you from stolen or homemade goggles and above wraparound masks that obviously used to be somebody's clothes. They do not attack, however. They gather and watch you with Mashish. You stare as he circles you, levering himself along rapidly. He's wearing calmless rags, long-sleeved and layered, but you can see how big his shoulder and arm muscles are under the tattered cloth. The rest of him is scrawny. The gauntness of his face is painful to see, but it's clear what his body has prioritized during the long, hungry months. Akete, you say, because you remember that he always preferred the name he was born with. He stops circling and peers at you for a moment, head tilted. Maybe this helps him see better with one functioning eye. The look on his face tells you off, though. He's not Arkete, any more than you are Demaya. Too much has changed. Mashish it is, then. You remembered, he says, though. In that moment of stillness, this I, in his previous storm of words, you glimpse the thoughtful, charming boy you remember, even though the coincidence of this is almost too much to digest. The only thing stranger would be running into. The brother you actually forgot you had until just now. What was his name? Earth fires, you've forgotten that too. But you probably wouldn't recognize him if you saw him. The grits of the fulcrum were your siblings. In pain, if not in blood. You shake your head to focus and nod. You're on your feet now, dusting leaf litter and ash off your butt, though awkwardly around the pulling weight on your chest. I'm surprised I remember too. You must have made an impression. He smiles. It's lopsided. Only half his face works the way it should. I forgot. Tried hard to, anyway. You set your jaw, steeling yourself. I'm sorry. It's pointless. He probably doesn't even remember what you're sorry about. He shrugs. Doesn't matter. It does. No. He looks away for a moment. I should have talked to you after. Shouldn't have hated you the way I did. Shouldn't have let her, them, change me. But I did, and now, none of that matters. You know exactly which her he's referring to. After that whole incident with crack, bullying that exposed a whole network of grits just trying to survive, and a larger network of adults exploiting their desperation. You remember? Mashish, returning to the grit barracks one day, with both his hands broken. Better than what they did to crack, you murmur, before it occurs to you not to say this. Yet he nods, unsurprised. Went to a node station once. It wasn't her. Rust knows what I was thinking, but I wanted to search them all. before the season. He utters a ragged, bitter chuckle. I didn't even like her. Just needed to know. You shake your head. Not that you don't understand the impulse. You'd be lying if you said you hadn't thought it too, in the years since you learned the truth. Go to all the stations. Figure out some way to restore their damaged Sesapine and set them free. Or kill them as a kindness. Ah, you'd have been such a good instructor if the Fulcrum had ever given you a chance. But of course, you did nothing. And of course, Mashish didn't do anything to save the node maintainers either. Only Alabaster ever managed that. You take a deep breath. I'm with them, you say, jerking your head back toward the road. You heard what the head woman said. Orochins, welcome. He sways a little, there on his stumps and arms. It's hard to see his face in the dark. I confess her. She's the head woman? Yeah, and everyone in the comm knows it. There, this comm is... And you take a deep breath. We are a comm that's trying to do something different. Origins and Stills, not killing each other. He laughs, which sets off a few moments of coughing. The other stick figures chuckle too, but it's Mashish's cough that worries you. It's dry, hacking, pebbly, not a good sound. He's been breathing too much ash without a mask. It's loud, too. If the hunters aren't nearby watching, and perhaps ready to shoot him and his people, you'll eat your runny sack. At the end of the coughing fit, he tilts his head up at you again, with an amused look in his eye. I'm doing the same thing, he drawls. With his chin, he points toward his gathered people. These rusters stick with me because I'm not going to eat them. They don't fuck with me because I'll kill them. There, peaceful coexistence. You look around at them and frown. Hard to see their expressions. They didn't attack my people, though. Or they'd be dead. Nah, that was a lemshin. Mashish shrugs. It makes his whole body move. Half-sensed bastard. Got kicked out of two comms for anger management issues, he said. He would have gotten us all killed raiding. So I told anybody who wanted to live and could stand me to come follow me. And we did our own thing. This side of the forest is ours. That side was theirs. Two comless tribes, not one. Mashish's hardly qualifies, though, only a handful of people besides himself. But he said it. Those who could endure living with a Raga went with him. That just didn't turn out to be a lot of people. Mashish turns and climbs halfway up to the blind again, so he can sit down and also be on an eye level with you. He lets out another rattly cough from the effort of doing this. I figure he was expecting me to hit you lot, he continues, once the coughing subsides. That's how we usually do it. I ice him. His group grabs what it can before I and mine can show up. We both get enough to go on a little longer. But I was all fucked up from what your head woman said. He looks away, shaking his head. Olemshin should have broken off once he saw I wasn't going to ice you, but, well... I did say he was going to get them killed. Yeah. Good riddance. What happened to your arm? He's looking at you now. He can't see your left breast, even though you're slouching a little to the left. It hurts, weighing on your flesh. You counter. What happened to your legs? He smiles lopsidedly and doesn't answer. Neither do you. So... Not killing each other. Mashish shakes his head. And that's actually working out? So far. We're trying, anyway. Won't work. Mashish shifts again and darts another look at you. How much did it cost you to join them? You don't say nothing, because that's not what he's asking, anyway. You can see the bargain he's made for survival here. His skills, in exchange for the raiders' limited food and dubious shelter. This stone forest, this death trap, is his doing. How many people did he kill for his raiders? How many have you killed for Kostrima? Not the same. How many people were in Renanus's army? How many of them did you sentence to be steam-cooked alive by insects? How many ash mounds dot Kostrima over now, each with a hand or booted foot poking out? Not the rusting same, that was them or you. Just like Mashish trying to survive, him or them. You then set your jaw to silence this internal argument. There isn't time for this. We can't. You attempt, then shift. There are other ways besides killing. Other. We don't just have to be this. Yika's words, awkward and oily with hypocrisy from your mouth. And are those words even true anymore? Kostrima no longer has the geode to force cooperation between Origin and Still. Maybe it'll all fall apart tomorrow. Maybe. But until then, you force yourself to finish. We don't have to be what they made us, Mashish. He shakes his head, staring at the leaf litter. You remember that name, too. You lick your lips. Yeah. I'm Esun. He frowns a little at this, perhaps because it isn't a stone-themed name. That's why you picked it. He doesn't question it, though. At last, he sighs. Rusting, look at me, Esun. Listen to the rocks in my chest. Even if your head woman will take half a raga, I'm not going to last much longer. Also, because he's sitting, he can use his hands. He gestures around at the other scarecrow figures. No, Calm will let us in, says one of the smaller figures. You think that's a woman's voice, but it's so hoarse and weary, you can't tell. Don't even play that game. You shift, uncomfortable. The woman is right. Ika might be willing to take in a calmless raga, but not the rest. Then again, you can never figure out quite what Ika will do. I can ask. Chuckles all around, jaded and thin and tired. A few more rattly coughs in addition to Mashish's. These people are starved nearly to death, and half of them are sick. This is pointless. Still, to Mashish you say, if you don't come with us, you'll die here. Olemshin's people had most of the supplies. We'll go take them. That sentence ends on a pause, the opening bid in a bargain. And it's all of us, or none of us. Up to the head woman, you say, refusing to commit. But you know haggling when you hear it. Is Fulcrum trained Orogeny in exchange for calm membership for him and his handful, with the deal sweetened by the raiders' supplies. And he's fully prepared to walk away if Yika can't meet his opening price. It bothers you. I'll also put in a good word for your character, or at least your character 30 years ago. He smiles a little. Hard not to see that smile as patronizing. Look at you, trying to make this something more than it is. You're probably projecting. I also know a little about the area. Might be useful, since you're obviously going somewhere. He jerks his chin toward firelight, reflecting off the crags closer to the road. You are going someplace. Renanus. Assholes. Which means the Renanus army must have come through the area on its way south. You let yourself smile. Dead, assholes? Huh. He squints his good eye. They've been smashing comms all over the area. That's why we've had such a hard time. No trade caravans to raid once the Rennies were done. I did sess something weird in the direction they went, though. He falls silent, watching you. Because, of course, he knows. Any raga with rings should have sensed the activity of the obelisk gate when you ended the Renanus-Kostrima war so decisively. They might not have known what they were sensing. And unless they were magic, they wouldn't have perceived the totality of it, even if they'd known. But they would have at least picked up the backwash. That was me, you say. It's surprisingly hard to admit. Rusting earth, Essen, how? You take a deep breath, extend a hand to him. So much of your past keeps coming back to haunt you. You can never forget where you came from, because it won't rusting let you. But because Yika's got the right of it, you can reject these dregs of your old self and pretend that nothing and no one else matters. Or you can embrace them, reclaim them for what they're worth, and grow stronger as a whole. Let's go talk to Yika, you say. If she adopts you and your people, I know. I'll tell you everything. And if he's not careful, you'll end up teaching him how to do it, too. He's a six-ringer, after all. If you fail, someone else will have to take up the mantle. To your surprise, he regards your hand with something akin to wariness. Not sure I want to know everything. It makes you smile. You really don't. He smiles lopsidedly. You don't want to know everything that's happened to me, either. You incline your head. Deal, then. Only the good parts. He grins. One of his teeth is missing. That's too short to even make a good pop loris tale. Nobody would buy a story like that. But then he shifts his weight and lifts his right hand. The skin is thick as horn, beyond calloused and filthy. You wipe your hand on your pants without thinking after. His people chuckle at this. Then you lead him back toward Kastrima, into the light. 2470, Antarctics. Massive sinkhole began to open beneath city of Bendine. Calm died shortly after. Karst soils, not seismic, but the sinking of the city generated waves that Antarctic fulcrum origins detected. From the fulcrum, somehow shifted whole city to more stable position, saving most of population. Fulcrum records note that doing this killed three senior origins. Project notes of Yater, Innovator, Deepars. 6. Nasun makes her fate. The month-long journey to Steel's Dedsiv ruin is uneventful by the standards of mid-season travel. Nasun and Shafa have, or forage sufficient food, to sustain themselves, though both of them begin to lose weight. Nasun's shoulder heals without trouble, though she is feverish and weak for a couple of days at one point. And on those days, Shafa calls a halt for rest, sooner than she thinks he normally would have. On the third day, the fever is gone, the wound is beginning to scab, and they resume. They encounter almost no one else on the road, though that is unsurprising a year and a half into the season. Anyone still calmless at this point has joined a raider band, and there won't be many of those left, just the most vicious, or the ones with some kind of edge beyond savagery and cannibalism. Most of those will have gone north, into the Somidlats, where there are more calms to prey upon. Not even raiders like the Antarctics. In many ways, the near solitude suits Nasun fine. No other guardians to tiptoe around, no calm folk whose irrational fears must always be planned for. Not even other origin children. Nasun misses the others. Misses their chatter and the comradeship that she enjoyed with them for so brief a time. But at the end of the day, she resented how much time and attention Shafa had to give them. She's old enough to know that it's childish for her to be jealous of such a thing. Her parents doted on Uche, too. But it is horrifyingly obvious now that getting more attention isn't necessarily favoritism. Doesn't mean she isn't glad and greedy for the chance to have Shafa all to herself. Their time together is companionable and largely silent by day. At night, they sleep curled together against the deepening cold, secure because Nossun has reliably demonstrated that the slightest shift in the ambient or footstep upon the nearby ground is enough to wake her. Sometimes Shafa does not sleep. He tries, but instead lies shuddering minutely, catching his breath now and again with half-suppressed muscle twitches, trying not to disturb her in his quiet agonies. When he does sleep, it is fitful and shallow. Sometimes Nossun does not sleep either, aching in silent sympathy. So she resolves to do something about it. It's the thing she learned to do back in Found Moon, though to a lesser degree. She sometimes lets the little core stone in his sesapine have some of her silver. She doesn't know why it works, but she recalls seeing the guardians in Found Moon all taking bits of silver from their charges and exhaling afterward, as if it eased something in them to give the core stone someone else to chew on. Shafa, however, has not taken silver from her or anyone else since the day she offered all of hers to him, the day she realized the true nature of the metal shard in his brain. She thinks maybe she understands why he stopped. Something changed between them that day, and he can no longer bring himself to feed on her like some sort of parasite. But that is why Nossun sneaks him magic now, because something changed between them. And he's not a parasite if she needs him too, and if she gives what he will not take. One day soon she will learn the word symbiosis and nod, pleased to have a name for it at last. But long before that, she will have already decided that family will do. When Nossun gives Shafa her silver, though he is asleep, his body swallows it so quickly that she must snatch her hand away to avoid losing too much. She can spare only dribbles. Any more and she will be the tired one and unable to travel the next day. Even that tiny amount is enough to let him sleep, however. And as the days pass, Nossun finds herself gradually making more silver somehow. It's a welcome change. Now she can ease his pain better without wearying herself. Every time she sees Shafa settle into a deep, peaceful sleep, she feels proud and good, even though she knows she isn't. Doesn't matter. She is determined to be a better daughter to Shafa than she was to Jicha. Everything will be better until the end. Shafa sometimes tells stories in the evenings while dinner cooks. In them, the humanness of the past is a place both wondrous and strange, as alien as the bottom of the sea. It is always the humanness of the past. Recent humanness is lost to him, along with his memories of the Shafa he used to be. Even the idea of humanness is hard for Nossun to comprehend. Millions of people, none of them farmers or miners or anything that fits within the range of her experience, many of them obsessed with strange fads and politics and alignments far more complex than those of caste or race. Leaders, but also the elite humanness in leadership families. Strong backs of the union and those without, varying by their connections and financial security. Innovators from generations-old families who competed to be sent off to the 7th university. And innovators who merely built and repaired trinkets out of the city's shanty towns. It is strange to realize that much of humanness's strangeness was simply because it lasted so long. It had old families. Books in its libraries that were older than Tarimo. Organizations that remembered and avenged slights from 3 or 4 seasons back. Shafa also tells her about the fulcrum, although not much. There is another memory hole here, deep and fathomless as an obelisk, though Nossun finds herself unable to resist probing its edges. It is a space that her mother once inhabited, after all. And in spite of everything, this fascinates her. Shafa remembers Esun poorly, however, even when Nossun works up the courage to ask direct questions about the matter. He tries to answer Nasun, but his speech is halting when he does, and the look that crosses his face is pained, troubled, paler than usual. She therefore forces herself to ask these questions slowly, hours or days apart, to give him time to recover in between. What she learns is little more than she has already guessed about her mother and the fulcrum, and life before the season. It helps to hear it, nevertheless. The miles pass like this, in memory, and edged around pain. Conditions in the Antarctic grow worse by the day. The ashfall is no longer intermittent, and the landscape has begun to turn into a still life of hills and ridges and dying plants chiseled in gray-white. Nasun starts to miss the sight of the sun. One night they hear the squeals of what must be a large kirkuza romp out hunting, though fortunately the sound is distant. One day they pass a pond whose surface is mirror gray from floating ash. The water underneath is disturbingly still, given that the pond is fed by a rapid stream. Although their canteens are low, Nasun looks at Shafa, and Shafa nods in silent, wary agreement. There's nothing overtly wrong, but, well, surviving a season is as much a matter of having the right instincts as having the right tools. They avoid the still water and live. On the evening of the 29th day, they reach a place where the Imperial Road abruptly plateaus and veers southward. Nasun assesses that the road edges along something that feels a bit like a crater rim. They have crested the ridge that surrounds this circular, unusually flat region, and the road follows the ridge in an arc around the zone of old damage, resuming its westward track on the other side. In the middle, though, Nasun at last beholds a wonder. The old man's pucker is a somian, a caldera inside a caldera. This one is unusual in being so perfectly formed. From what Nasun has read, usually the outer, older caldera is badly damaged by the eruption that creates the inner, newer caldera. In this case, the outer one is an intact, nearly perfect circle, though heavily eroded by time and forested over. Nasun can't really see it under the greenery, though she can sense it clearly. The inner caldera is a little more oblong, and it gleams so brightly from a distance that Nasun can guess what happened without even sensing it. The eruption must have been so hot, at least at one point, that the whole geological formation nearly destroyed itself. What remains has gone to glass, naturally tempered enough that not even centuries of weathering has damaged it much. The volcano that created this somian is extinct now, its ancient magma chamber long since emptied, not even a whiff of leftover heat lingering. Once upon a time, though, the pucker was the site of a truly awesome and horrific puncturing of the world's crust. As Steel instructed, they camp for the night a mile or two back from the pucker. In the small hours before dawn, Nasun wakes, hearing a distant screech, but Shafa soothes her.
"I've heard that now and again," he says softly over the crackling of the fire.
He insisted on a watch this time, so Nasun took the earlier shift.
"Something in the pucker forest. It doesn't seem to be common this way."
She believes him, but neither of them sleeps well that night. In the morning they rise before dawn and start up the road. In the early morning light, Nasun stares at the deceptively still double crater before them. Up close, it's easier to see that there are breaks in the inner caldera's walls at regular intervals. Someone meant for people to be able to get inside. The outer caldera's floor is completely overgrown, however, yellow-green and waving with a forest of tree-like grasses that has apparently choked out every other form of vegetation in the area. There's no cess of even game trails across it. The real surprise, though, is underneath the pucker. "Steel's dead civ ruin," she says,
It's underground. Shafa glances at her in surprise, but he does not protest.
In the magma chamber?
Maybe. Nasun can't believe it either at first, but the silver does not lie. She notices something else strange as she expands her Susunal awareness of the area. The silver mirrors the perturbations of topography and the forest here, the same way it does everywhere. Yet the silver here is brighter somehow, and it seems to flow more readily from plant to plant and rock to rock. These blend to become larger, dazzling flows that all run together like streams until the ruin sits within a pool of glimmering, churning light. She can't make out the details, there's so much of it. Just empty space and an impression of buildings. It's huge, this ruin. A city, like no city Nasun has ever sensed. But she has sensed this torrential churn of silver before. She cannot help turning to glance back toward the sapphire that is faintly visible some miles off. They've outpaced it, but it's still following.
Yes, Shafa says.
He's been watching her, and missing nothing as she makes the connections.
I don't remember this city, but I know of others like it. The obelisks were made in such places.
She shakes her head, trying to fathom it all.
What happened to this city? There must have been a lot of people here once. The shattering.
She inhales. She's heard of it, of course, and believed in it the way children believe most stories. She remembers seeing an artist's line rendering of the event in one of her creche books. Lightning and rocks falling from the sky, fire erupting from the ground, tiny human figures running and doomed.
So that's what it was like? A big volcano?
The shattering was like this here.
Shafa gazes out over the waving forest.
Elsewhere, it was different. The shattering was 100 different seasons, Nasun, all over the world, all striking at once. It's a marvel that anything of humanity survived.
The way he's talking, it seems impossible, but Nasun bites her lip.
Were you?
Do you remember it?
He glances at Nasun, surprised, and then smiles in a way that is equal parts weary and wry.
I don't. I think, I suspect, that I was born sometime after, though I have no proof of that. Even if I could remember the shattering, though, I feel fairly certain that I wouldn't want to.
He sighs, then shakes his head.
The sun is up. Let's face the future at least, and leave the past to itself.
Nasun nods, and they step off the trail into the trees. The trees are strange things, with long thin leaves, like elongated grass blades, and narrow flexible trunks that grow no more than a couple of feet apart. In some places, Shafa has to stop and push apart two or three trees so that they can wriggle through. This makes for hard going, though, and before long Nasun is out of breath. She stops, dripping sweat, but Shafa pushes on.
Shafa,
she says, about to ask for a break.
No, he says, pushing over another tree with a grunt. Remember the Stone Eater's warning, little one. We must reach the center of this forest by dusk. It's now clear we will need every moment of that time.
He's right. Nasun swallows, starts taking deeper breaths so that she can work better, and then resumes pushing through the forest with him. She develops a rhythm working with him. She's good at finding the quickest paths that don't require pushing through, and when she does, he follows her. When these paths end, however, he shoves and kicks and breaks trees until the way is clear, while she follows. She can catch her breath during these brief lulls, but it's never quite enough. A stitch develops in her side. She starts having trouble seeing because the tree leaves keep pulling some of her hair loose from its twin buns, and sweat has made the curls lengthen and dangle into her eyes. She wants desperately to rest for an hour or so, drink some water, eat something. The clouds overhead get grayer as the hours pass, however, and it becomes increasingly hard to tell how much daylight is left. I can, Nasun tries at one point, while trying to think of how she can use Orogeny or the silver or something to clear the way. No, Shafa says, somehow intuiting what she would have said. He's produced a black glass poniard from somewhere. It's not a useful knife for this situation, although somehow he has made it so, by stabbing each of the grass tree trunks before kicking them down. That helps them break more easily.
Freezing these plants would only make them more difficult to get through, and a shake could cause the magma chamber below us to collapse.
The silver, then?
No.
He stops for only a moment and turns to fix a hard gaze on her. He's not breathing harder, she notes with great chagrin, although a faint sheen of sweat does glisten on his forehead. His iron shard punishes him, but still grudgingly grants him greater strength.
Other guardians may be near, Nasun. It's unlikely at this point, but still a possibility.
All Nasun can do is grope for another question, because this momentary pause is giving her time to catch her breath. Other guardians? Ah, but then he has said that they'll all go somewhere during a season, and that this station that Steele told them about is the means by which they do it. Do you remember something?
Nothing more, sadly.
He smiles a little knowingly, as if he can tell what she is doing.
Only that this is how we get there.
Get where?
His smile fades, expression settling into that familiar, disturbing blankness for the briefest of instants.
Warrant.
She remembers, belatedly, that his full name is Shafa Guardian Warrant. It has never occurred to her to wonder where the calm of Warrant is. But what does it mean that the way to Warrant is through a buried dead city?
Why?
He shakes his head then, expression hardening.
Stop stalling. In this low light, not every nocturnal hunter will wait for night.
He glances up at the sky with a look that is only mildly annoyed, as if it does not threaten their lives. It's pointless to complain that she is ready to drop. It's the season. If she drops, she dies. So she forces herself through the gap he has broken and starts questioning again for the best route. In the end, they make it, which is good, because otherwise this would become the rather straightforward tale of you learning that your daughter is dead and letting the world wither in your grief. It isn't even a near thing. Abruptly, the last patch of thick grass trees thins out, revealing a smooth-cut pass through the inner caldera ring. The walls of the pass loom high overhead, though they did not look so tall from far away, and the pass itself is wide enough for two horse-drawn carriages to travel side by side without crowding. The walls of these passages are covered in tenacious mosses and some sort of woody vine, the latter of which is fortunately dead, because otherwise it might entangle them and slow their progress more. Instead, they hurry forward, cracking the dead branches aside, and then abruptly, Nasun and Shafa stumble out of the pass onto a wide round slab of perfectly white material that is neither metal nor stone. Nasun's seen something like it before, near other dead civ ruins. Sometimes the stuff glows faintly at night. This particular slab fills the entirety of the space within the inner caldera. Steele has told them that the dead civ ruin is here at the center, but all Nasun sees ahead of them is a dainty, rising curl of metal, seemingly set directly into the white material. She tenses, as wary of something new as any seasoned survivor. Shafa, however, walks over to it without hesitation. He stops beside it, and for an instant, There is an odd expression on his face that Narsen suspects is caused by the momentary conflict between what his body has done out of habit and what his mind cannot remember. But then he puts a hand on the curlicue at the tip of the metal. Flat shapes and lines of light suddenly appear out of nothingness on the stone around him. Narsen gasps, but they do nothing other than march and ignite others in turn, spreading and glowing until a roughly rectangular shape has been etched out on the stone at Shafa's feet. There is a faint, barely audible hum that makes Narsen twitch and look around wildly, but a moment later the white material in front of Shafa vanishes. It doesn't slide aside or open like a door. It's just gone. But it is a doorway, Narsen abruptly realizes.
"And here we are," Shafa murmurs.
He sounds a little surprised himself. Beyond this doorway is a tunnel that curves gradually down into the ground and out of sight. Narrow rectangular panels of light edge the steps on either side, illuminating the way. The curling bit of metal is a railing she sees now, her perception reorienting as she moves to stand beside Shafa. Something to hold on to as one walks down into the depths. In a distant part of the grass forest that they just traversed, there is a high-pitched grating noise that Narsen immediately identifies as animal. Chitinous, maybe. A closer, louder version of the screeches they heard the night before. Narsen flinches and looks at Shafa.
"Some sort of grasshopper, I believe," he says, his jaws tight as he gazes back at the pass they just traversed,
though nothing moves there yet.
"Or cicadas, perhaps. Inside now. I've seen something like this mechanism before. It should close after we pass through."
He gestures for her to go first so that he can guard the rear. Narsen takes a deep breath and reminds herself that this is what is necessary to make a world that will hurt no one else. Then she trots down the stairs. The light panels ignite 5 or 6 steps ahead as she progresses and fade 3 steps behind. Once they're a few feet down, just as Shafa predicted, the white material that covered the stairwell reappears, cutting off further screeches from the forest. Then there is nothing but the light and the stairs and the long-forgotten city somewhere below. 2699. 2 fulcrum blackjackets summoned to Dijna Kam, Ur Kortent, western coastals, near Kiosh Traps, when Mount Immer showed eruption signs. Blackjackets informed Kam officials that eruption was imminent and that it would likely touch off the whole Kiosh cluster, including Madness, local name for the supervolcano that triggered the Madness season. Immer sits on the same hot spot. Upon determining that Immer was beyond their ability to quell, the black jackets, 1 3-ringer, the other supposedly 7, although did not wear rings for some reason, made the attempt anyway, due to insufficient time to send for higher-ringed Imperial origins. They successfully stilled the eruption long enough for a 9-ring senior Imperial origin to arrive and push it back into dormancy. 3-ringer and 7-ringer found holding hands, charred, frozen. Project Notes of Yater Innovator D-Bars. Syl Anagist. 3. Fascinating. All of this grows easier to remember with the telling. Or perhaps I am still human, after all. At first, our field excursion is simply the act of walking through the city. We have spent the brief years since our initial decanting immersed in Sesuna, the sense of energy in all its forms. A walk outside forces us to pay attention to our other, lesser senses, and this is initially overwhelming. We flinch at the springiness of pressed fiber sidewalks under our shoes, so unlike the hard lacquer wood of our quarters. We sneeze, trying to breathe air thick with smells of bruised vegetation and chemical byproduct.